Well, good morning. I'd like to have you open your Bibles, please. Genesis chapter 10. Last week, we covered five verses, chapter 10, verses 1 through 5, with the line of Japheth. I was kind of concerned beginning it, going through the names, the genealogy. It seemed to go well. I was pleased with the results. We had people wanting CDs of it. They heard it online, wanted copies of it, so we'll see what we can do with the next genealogy. We're plowing some tough ground here. We are in chapter 10, beginning in verse 6, and today we're going to talk about the line of Ham. Of course, Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So we're not going to Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham and Shem. Last week ended the discussion We went through and had the descendants of Japheth basically extending from the Middle East, going north into Russia, and going Turkey or Asia Minor into Greece, Italy, west into Tarshish or Spain, and filling the European world or hitting the Atlantic Ocean. That became a group of people or different nations, borders, and languages, a race of people that developed their own characteristics, both in culture. In their physical look. As we ended last week, you'll remember we had the invasion of the north, the leader, Gog of Magog, which is southern Russia in that area, came down into Israel of Persia, which would be Iran, and some North African countries like Libya. We'll introduce some of those here today. And they were defeated. They were defeated by God and wiped out. It's an event that yet to take place. Look at scripture in Ezekiel chapter 39 in that time area. We're going to talk about Ham. Ham is going to become the people again in the Middle East. Remember, they all Shem, Ham, and Japheth all started in the Middle East and extend north for Japheth, south with Ham, and in a general sense to the east with Shem. And they all overlap in that middle area. But today, we're going to see Ham and where Ham settles and some interesting things as far as where Ham gets involved in history. And like last week, we ended with the invasion and destruction of Japheth. Today, possibly, if we go through this correctly, we'll see how the line of Ham ties into the future events and see the overthrow of their rebellion. We saw Japheth's overthrow of their rebellion last week. This week we'll see Ham's overthrow. And then next week all that will be left will be Ham and their descendants. Well, first of all, if you look on your sheets, a notes sheet right there, you can see at the top there's a box that has name Ham. 30 nations are listed as coming from Ham. Again, as we put them all together, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all the nations listed, there's a total of 70, a number of completion. From Ham, there are listed four sons of Ham. You can see them right there, Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. Then underneath each of those is a column, and the descendants of Cush are listed. Just random names, apparently, not much sense to it. I hope I can add a little bit of continuity or connection to these. Mizraim, there's a list again under him. And under Canaan, there's the largest list. Again, it's interesting because Canaan is the land that is going to be promised to Israel. Even in the verses today, the borders of Canaan are going to be listed. Because it is important for Israel to understand when God says, I give you the land of Canaan, where those borders are, the boundaries are going to be given. If you look at that first column under Cush, and those names that we'll go through here just real quickly, that is the peoples under Mizraim. Notice, remember the word Elohim? Ends with the I am. It means God, but it's in the plural sense or in the dual with the I am on the end. Mizraim, you can see it right there. The I am is plural. It's the Hebrew word right there for Egypt, but it's plural, Egypt, which means upper and lower Egypt. Just the way all history breaks it down, you've got upper and lower Egypt. Don't get confused when you refer to upper and lower Egypt because upper Egypt is not north. Upper Egypt is up. The river at the beginning of the source of the Nile, which is actually south, because rivers flow the different direction in that part of the hemisphere. So, all these nations listed under Mizraim, or Egypt, are in northern Africa. Northeast Africa, and are most of them. They're kind of general area. They relate to those people. Which of and maybe you'll say, none of them, I'm already bored, I can't see anything positive coming out of today's message. But if you look at the three columns, if any of you are still awake, where you've got the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, maybe not either. But these are the ones that you would judge. And so they continue the keep popping up because they are settling where? In the land of Canaan. So that first Arabia, south of Israel in the Arabian Peninsula, Midian in Egypt, northeastern Africa, and Canaan, people settled in the land of Canaan, the Phoenicians in that general area. So that's kind of like a general introduction. We're going to talk more about those as we go. Well, let's go ahead and read our text today. Genesis 10, verse 6. The sons of Ham, Cush, Ephraim, Put, and Canaan. And that's not, now we already got them listed already on that chart. The sons of Cush, write down that column. Havilah, Sabta, Rama, and Saptica. The sons of Rama. Now there's two other sons now of Ham. Sheba, we'll talk about them when we get. Then we insert here, which is going to be very, very little storyline. Was the father of Nimrod. Notice, Nimrod is not on that list. He's just a son of Cush. He's going to be a mighty warrior. He's going to be a mighty leader. He's going to be a mighty hunter. But apparently, he himself become a people group. He is a man, he was a leader, but it appears his dynasty or his people, there's nothing from him. Does some things. So he's not listed. I've got him in parentheses on my list because he is a son of Cush, but he's not on a map anywhere. But nonetheless, this is what it says about Nimrod. We will come back. Cush was the father of Nimrod, who grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. So there he is, a warrior. He was a mighty hunter, referring to possibly, most likely, animals or wild beasts, before the Lord. And that's a phrase we're going to have to talk about, before the Lord. What's that mean? That is why it is said, and here's a quote that even came down in Israel's writings, many generations, has been handed down through the generations, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. It's a proverbial saying. It's a quote. It's something that has a meaning. It's like, yeah, well, it's just like Nimrod, who was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And what does that mean? I mean, what is that positive? Is it negative? Is it a warning? Is it a praise? Is it a compliment? What does that mean when someone would say, yeah, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord? We'll talk about that. The first centers of his kingdom, and now it lists the capitals of his kingdom, were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Kelna in Shinar. Now, you know where Shinar's at. That's in over the Euphrates, Tigris River, Mesopotamia, the land of Babylon. In fact, let's go ahead and get started on the maps. If you go to page 6, there is Nimrod's cities. I'm doing this now because if I get a hole in here, I may show this to you. And in the south there, in the southern part of the map, you can see Babylon, Akkad, and Erech. Those are the cities there that were in, and then Kelna is also listed. We're not sure exactly where Kelna is. Obviously, it's probably around the Babylon area. It's in southern Mesopotamia. And that is where Nimrod set up and began building cities. But then apparently, because he's a mighty warrior, a mighty leader, a mighty hunter, as it is said, Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord, he began to expand, and he moved up into Assyria, or he moved north, and he began to build cities there. In other words, he's building an empire. He's conquering the world. He's doing what Alexander the Great is going to do, what Cyrus was going to do. He's doing what the pharaohs were trying to do. He's building an empire. From that land, in verse 11, from that land he went to Assyria, where he built Nineveh. Now notice, you've already recognized two cities for sure, if you've gone, you know, been around the Bible at all. Babylon in the south and Nineveh in the north. And Nineveh is going to be from, you know, the days of Jonah, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, going to cause some problems for Israel. So right away, just by saying Babylon and Nineveh, you kind of have this taste in your mouth, especially if you're Jewish, of like, this can't be good. Because Babylon overthrew Israel. Nineveh is the source of the Assyrians who came down and overthrew Israel, or the northern tribes, and then invaded the tribe of Judah. So right away, this whole flavor here is like, these are not good places. But it's not real clear what's going on here yet. From the land, he went to Assyria, where he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ira, Kelna, and Rezin, which is between Nineveh and Kelna, that is the great city. Now, we know for sure where Nineveh's at. They've excavated that. They know where Kelna's at. In fact, it's the modern city. You may want to write this down. Interesting. It's the name of the modern city called Nimrud. N-I-M-R-U-D. Sound familiar? Sounds a lot like Nimrod, okay? We don't know where Rezin is at, but it says right here in the text that it's between Nineveh and Kelna. So on my map, I put a dot there between those two cities because that's where it's at. Haven't found it yet. I mean, how about that? We know where Nineveh's at. We know where Kelna's at. They've excavated those cities. That's not hard to find. Nobody, there's not even a debate. And right between those cities is Rezin. There you go. Can't find it. Indicating, you know, possibly some kind of great tragedy, some kind of, you know, when God wipes out a place. A couple other places they have never found. Sodom and Gomorrah. It's like where that they think they're at the bottom of the Dead Sea. I mean, when God says it's gone, it's you're not going to excavate this place. I'm not saying it's probably not there. It's probably not true. I'm not indicating there's an error in the scriptures. I'm saying certain these places God has eliminated, and you know we're not going to find. But nonetheless, it goes through and lists those cities there in Assyria. Now we go to Mizraim in verse 13, and this was one of Ham's sons. Again, this is Egypt now. Mizraim was the father of the Luddites, the Anamites, the Lahabites, the Naphthuhites, the Pathrusites, the Casluhites, and there's an interesting little parenthesis right here, from whom the Philistines came, and the Caphtorites. Now, just because you're really interested in this, there's going to be something we're going to talk about, because later on in the Old Testament, it says the Philistines came from the Caphtorites. So we've got a situation here. Maybe it's a mistranslation. Maybe we've got to work with a different way of interpreting this. But here it says Casluhites, which produced the Philistines. And then the Caphtorites, later on it says this is where they came from. I'll explain that to you. Verse 15, Canaan, now here's the last one, the last son. Canaan, and remember, this is the son that was cursed. When Ham had his episode with his father, when his father had been drinking and was in his tent, Canaan ended up being cursed as after Ham had done the actions. So this is the line that was cursed. Understand, everybody we've read so far has not in under the curse that came because of Ham's action. Canaan is. And so whatever that curse means, if that curse were to extend for generation after generation, which it may have, or it may have just been a curse on the man Canaan, not on his descendants forever and ever. But nonetheless, these are the people then that settled in the land of Canaan that we'll look at. In fact, if you want to, go ahead and turn to page 5. And this map should look familiar. This is the map of Israel. You can see I've got Jerusalem right there. I've got a dot right in the middle. It's called Jabesh. And again, I've got Jerusalem written on there. Understand real quickly as we go through this, the city of Jabesh was occupied by the Jebusites, which are listed here as the descendants of Canaan, up until the time of David, around 1000 BC, when David finally broke into Jerusalem. No one could take it. It could not be conquered. The king of Jabesh was killed during Joshua's day. We need to spend some time on that because it's interesting there. Melchizedek was the king and priest of Salem in Abram's day. It's coming up here in the scriptures in Genesis. And the city was called Salem. By Joshua's day, the line of Melchizedek is still there, like several generations. He's got the same last name, Melchizedek, and the last name, Ledek, is still there as a king in the city called now Jabesh. That king is killed, but the city is not taken. And then finally, within 200 or 300 years, David comes and the city is taken. But it was established, as it says in other places in Scripture, the Amorites and the Hivites got together and actually formed that city. It says that in Ezekiel. And then the Jebusites settled in there. But nonetheless, you can see Jerusalem on there. Now we're going to read through this list, and you can find some places on this map of Canaan. This is one of the important sections right here, especially for Israel. Verse 15, Canaan was the father of Sidon. You can see Sidon on there. His firstborn, and the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Later, the Canaanite clans scattered. And the borders of Canaan reached... Okay, why did they scatter? Well, we're going to find out in chapter 11 that God is going to scatter them throughout the earth. And this word scattered may refer to that scattering. But understand this. The scattering of these tribes throughout this land right here is a result of the Tower of Babel. Why were the Canaanite tribes scattered maybe later? The invasion of Israel. When Israel came to land, scattered them. They didn't kill everyone at last of the Canaanites. The Canaanites knew they were coming, and they had 40 years to flee. I mean, they had plenty of time to leave. So many of them would have fled and were scattered with the invasion of the Israelites, and then they were to kill all that remained in the land. It says, later the Canaanite clan scattered, and the borders of Canaan reach, and here we go, from Sidon, which is up towards the north, towards Gera, which is down in the land of the Philistines on the left corner of your map, bottom left corner, as far as Gaza, still the Gaza Strip today, and then towards Saba and Gomorrah, which is towards the Dead Sea there, Adma and Zeboim, which are part of the Dead Sea area, part of the Sodom and Gomorrah story, and as far as Laisha. And I've got Laisha just on the east side of the Dead Sea there. And I made this map 20 years ago and added some things to it. You can see the type stuff and the handwritten stuff. But Laisha may actually be Dan in the north. So that may go back up to Sidon, but further to the right. So it just puts a circle around the land that was given to the Canaanites, which then those boundaries are transferred to Moses in the book of Deuteronomy. These are the sons of Ham by their clans, language, in their territories, and nations. Again, I want to emphasize that God developed clans or some kind of families. He developed languages for each of them, territories, which are boundaries, and nations. So right here, God is establishing some kind of a race, a language, a border, and nationality established by God. And thus, he is going to use that for history. Well, let's go to the first page of our notes. And it'll be actually the second page. And I'm going to walk through these places. I'm going to try and do it quickly. And then we got a few things to tell you. First of all, we got the first son was Cush. And Cush is going to go down into the area, as you can see. It's going to be in Africa. You may want to, as I go through this list, why don't you go to page 4, and there's your map. It's the same map that we had last week for Japheth, except Japheth was in the Middle East, going north and then going west. Today now, we're going to start in the Middle East and go south. And again, the areas are going to be Canaan, Arabia, and then Egypt. I've got in bold letters there, I don't know if you can pick them out or not, you can see the sons of Ham there in bold letters. You can see Mizraim, which is in the middle, right by the Nile River. Go over to the right, you can see Cush in Arabia. Go north of that up to Israel, you can see Canaan. And then you can see Put over there in the land of Libya. Of those four, Put has no descendants listed. They all apparently settled in Put and just stayed there. They didn't split any people's groups, or they just didn't list them. But Mizraim, Cush, and Canaan are going to become the three groups we're looking at right here. So here we go. I'm going to run through this list, and you can kind of follow along right there on that map if you want to. Cush, as we know, or you can see where they're at, is going to be located in southern Egypt or in that area. It's Ethiopia in the Septuagint, not necessarily the Ethiopia of today, but in that area. Next, we're going to go to Mizraim, which is another name, which is Egypt itself. Again, we've already talked about it, meaning Upper and Lower Egypt. Put is Libya, which is today a terrorist state, if you want to say it that way. It's anti-Israel. It's filled with, you can read about it in the newspapers. They are listed as siding with Gog from Magog and the Northern Coalition and Iran. So this country of Put, according to Ezekiel, if it's still a future prophecy, is going to side with Russia, part of Asia Minor or Turkey, Iran, and then Libya for that final invasion, which I went ahead and stuck a map on here for you for that. So flip over to the very last page. This is where we ended up talking about last week. This is just review. You can see on the last page 7, the coming invasion of Israel, chapter 38 and 39 of Ezekiel. You can see the gray boxes are Gog's coalition, which include most of them are Japheth. But we do have with that Cush and Put, which are from Ham, that are joining with us. So you can see very clearly this is the terrorist states or the Muslim countries in the Middle East trying to wipe out the only democracy or the people of God in the Middle East. And in the clear boxes, the white Tarshish, which is Japheth to the west, Europe and Atlantic, the Western world, and Sheba and Dedan, which would be, in a sense, the Saudi Arabia area, those nations do not side with Gog. In fact, they ask Gog, they say, are you just coming here to plunder? This isn't a preemptive war. This isn't for self-defense. You're just coming to get the produce or whatever, you know, the oil or something from the land of Israel. And then God wipes them out. So anyway, Put is there, and you can see right there in Libya, that is where Put settled, and that is that nation there. Going on with this, we go to the next. We go to Canaan. Again, many details are listed there. That is the land of Canaan. Then we go to the sons of Cush. Here we go, Seba. Now, all the sons of Cush are going to be basically in Arabia. Seba is listed along with Egypt and Cush and Isaiah. It's probably an African people, no doubt. Herodotus and Josephus both call Seba the capital of Ethiopia or the ancient capital of Ethiopia. So that puts it there, you know, in northeast Africa. Hevela, it's related to Arabia. You can see it on the map. Sabta is the capital of a place in southern Arabia. Rama is named with Seba as being a trader with the city of Tyre. And so it's probably Yemen, which is very, you know, south of Saudi Arabia. It's the extent of furthest point of the Arabian Peninsula. Sapteka is southern Arabia also. Sheba, you remember Sheba, the queen of Sheba. This would be an area that is known, along with Sheba and Dedan, these are commercial traders. Sheba is in southern Arabia. Dedan is associated with Edom, which places it just south of the Dead Sea. So it'd be in northern Arabia area. And both of them are traders with Tyre, which is another descendant of Ham or Sidon. So a lot of trade going. A lot of these, I can give you references, which of course we're not going to look them up, but all the way through the Old Testament, they continue to refer back to these people groups as kind of like a guideline. The Luddites appear to have settled Asia Minor, had one of the few that had gone into Asia Minor and settled there. The Anamites, the sons of Mizraim, now we are in Egypt. The Anamites in the Libyan desert or west of Alexandria, so they're close to Put. You know, over in Libya. The Lehabites, associated with the Libyans, they're also over there towards Libya or towards the west of Egypt, filling northeastern Africa. And then, of course, moving south. The Nephthuhites, also with Libya. And these next three right here, if we put them all in order, next two, what they're doing is you can see on by the Nile River, they're filling in the Nile area as far as Upper Egypt, Middle Egypt, and Lower Egypt would be the delta. They're all settling within there. So Mizraim, then his sons filled in with that. The Kasluhites. These are a people that are associated in this verse right here with the Philistines. The Philistines are big players in the... we went to one of their cities last summer, Ashkelon. Saw the ancient city of Ashkelon, went through, picked up some things there. This last week, Ashkelon got bombed from the Gaza Strip. And in fact, when we went there, I remember asking the professor the day before we left, he has drawn this map, you know, and I was, a lot of people were aware that Gaza Strip was having a revolt or overthrow of the government between Hamas and Fatah were having their fight over, and they're taking over the offices and they're killing in the streets, and we were going to be going to a place that was like, you know, 8 miles from the Civil War. And so I went up after class. I says, because I was concerned for my wife because she's with us. I said, is this safe? And he looks at me, and he's been there since 1967 off, so he's seen that. He was there during the War of 67. He's seen, you know, all this. This is just like second nature for him. He goes, Hamas has nothing to do with Ashkelon. He said, they're not interested in that. He said, we'll be fine. So I took a word. We walked through the city, and of course, as we're going, the Philistines are, you know, have been extinct or wiped out for years. But I can't remember the guys we were traveling. City there, the modern city. People walk sidewalks up. I said, because here the professor was sitting right in front of us. Ask him if these were the. It was funny, because they weren't. But anyway, last week I was reading the newspaper, and Ashkelon got bombed by. They used homemade rockets they're making, but they actually got something that they picked up from some other country, maybe Iran or something. That they could actually launch, and they actually sent, I don't know if it was 30 people to the hospital, maybe more, maybe 40, that they actually hit part of Ashkelon and were moving out. So things are happening over there, as you know. But nonetheless, the Philistines, the Kasluhites, it says right here in the text, as we're looking at this, the Kasluhites are where the Philistines come from. What we have here is this is what takes place. Because they were probably settled towards Africa or in Egypt, they began to migrate, and this is not important, I'm just telling you. But they migrated up into Israel or Beersheba, southern Israel, and they became the Philistines, because you understand the Philistines in the book of Genesis. Abraham deals with them, Isaac deals with them, there are Philistines there. And the Philistines, during the time of Genesis, they that I talked to. But now, if you don't mind, I want you to go to Amos chapter 9. Yep. Amos chapter 9, verse 7. And we're going to read another verse that's going to say the Philistines came from Cathor, which is an ancient name for the island of Crete, which is, of course, in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. And that is going to take place later. So we've got two influences of Philistines. The original Philistines are descendants from Ham that migrated out of Egypt and were in land of Canaan, along with many of the other Canaanites, descendants of Ham, during the days of Abraham. Abraham dealt with them, talked with them, traded with them. But then later, a seafaring people from Crete, known as the Catharites, there was an invasion of Egypt. They began to battle with Egypt. And the Catharites were defeated, or there was a storm or something, and the Catharites never made it back, or the furthest they could make it, or close they could make it, was of Canaan, or the land of the Philistines. And that would have taken place later. Well, let's read here. If you're in Amos chapter 9, verse 7, here's the verse. We can see this in Ezekiel and a couple other verses. Three times this is mentioned in the Scripture. God is speaking, or Amos is, God is speaking through Amos. He says, Are not you Israelites the same as the up? They went down to Egypt as slaves, and then they got out. The Philistines from Cathor. I know that's not an exciting verse, but it says right here, God saying, I brought the Philistines from Cathor, Philistines from the Isle of Crete over to the land of Canaan. Goes on and says, and the Arameans from Kir, which is Mesopotamia, which is Babylon. And so the Philistines later on, sometime before Moses brings Israel out of Egypt, but after the time of Abraham, the Philistines had some kind of a battle. And this is, they did have the Egyptians record battles with the sea people, the Cathorites. They came and were defeated or shipwrecked or couldn't get any closer, and they settled on the coast. And this is now a second influx of the people. These are the people of Ham, but they've gone to the sea as Japheth did, but they end up coming back. They end up settling on the coast. And they adopted then the name of the Philistines. So you've got Philistines that migrated from Egypt up, from the Kashluhites, and then later on from the island of Crete, they came over again. And then when you get into the Philistines in the days of David, you notice they've got several kings. And what took place here, they actually came from the West, some new technology from the West that included iron. And when they arrived in Canaan with their iron that came from the Western world, remember, Parshish in the West, that's where they've got the smelting furnaces. They're advanced in their metal development. And they brought some of that technology into the land of Canaan, the Philistines did, in the days of Samuel, of Saul, days of the judges. Remember the days of judges? They'd have to take all of their tools to be sharpened over to the Philistines to sharpen them. In the days of Saul, it was illegal for the Israelites to have any kind of iron. There was two swords in Israel. Jonathan had a sword and Saul had a sword. And it was illegal. They could not have a blacksmith in Israel. You couldn't sharpen anything in Israel. You had to go over to the Philistines and have your tools sharpened. Your hoe or your harvesting equipment would be sharpened there. The Bible records this. And then they could come back. Because the Philistines wanted to keep close tabs on. And so the technology in the Philistines was more advanced. And that came from the Western world, that they when they came back from the island of Crete. Okay. And so that's where you've got, then you end up having kings in each city. There's actually five kings. So they had a different in culture and advance in technology. So you've got this coming together of two different groups of Philistines. Okay, that was fun. Now let's go back to our list. We're going now to the sons of Canaan going into the land of the Canaanites. Sidon, which is simply a Phoenician city, a trade city up by Tyre. The Hittites lived in the area of Judah. In the book of Genesis, the Hittites are the ones that Abraham, when Sarah died, he goes to a Hittite and buys the cave of Machpelah from the Hittites who are living there. So Abraham lived among all of these Canaanites. Abraham was living among the Jebusites. We mentioned they're the ones that are going to end up occupying Jerusalem. They're the ones who mock David. It says even the blind and lame can defend this city because it's such a well-fortified city, the city of Jerusalem. The Amorites, which is important if you want to notice this, the Amorites settled in Canaan, but they eventually move over towards Mesopotamia, and guys like Hammurabi are going to be from the Amorite division, and they end up in the land of Babel. So in other words, what's important here as we kind of wind this down is in Babylon, people that are going to be descendants of Ham. This is important. There are people there, and you may think, Japheth, but Japheth had moved north. You may think Ham moved south, and he did into Africa and Arabia, but they came to Canaan, and we've already mentioned Nimrod. We're going back to Nimrod. Nimrod built Babel, and he's a descendant of Cush, a descendant of Ham. The Amorites themselves settled in Canaan, but they ended up moving over back into the area of Mesopotamia, and that's where Hammurabi comes from. So when you start dealing with the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and this is probably, if you even care, and this is important, the Babylonians and the Assyrians are going to be descendants from Ham. They are related to Ham, which leads us to the second part of our story. You can read on through there. We got some other names there. I could give you the Hivites. That's where Shechem comes from, who ended up having a relationship with Dinah, Jacob's daughter. And on like that. But let's go, if you would please, let's go back to Genesis chapter 10 and look at Nimrod, because Nimrod is a descendant of Canaan. And this is setting a stage. Last week we saw Japheth begin. Japheth moved north and west. And in the end, Japheth united Israel with the help of some of the of Ham. Now we've got a guy right here. At the beginning of time, at the beginning of the nations, chapter 10, verse 8, Cush was the father of Nimrod. Nimrod is a word that means rebel. If you go back and trace this, as you go through, You're going to have a four-generation cycle. This was originally, these are the verses that spun me off 20 years ago into the four-generation cycle. And ended up with, we getting Proverbs 30 tied in. And this was the first, when I were doing a couple seminars in Oklahoma City at a couple conventions down there at the many years ago. And this was the verses, these were the verses that we originally started with right here. Of course, the thing, some better verses, I think. So we don't really use this so much. But notice right here, Nimrod means rebel. Cush, his father, it means the black one or the dark one. And Ham means burnt. So what you have there is a sequence. Burnt or burnt by the sun is what Ham means. He has a son whose name means, the black one, that no light is. Have as a sequence. You've got a sequence of someone who is, the light is there, but they're burnt or they're darkened by it. They have a son who is the black one. The light is penetrating. The third generation, Nimrod, is the rebel. The rebel. He is again, what's he rebelling against? And that sets the whole mood. Cush was the father of Nimrod. Anything you read from here on, you have to read the light of the understanding. Name means rebel. His father has been darkened in the sense he's rejected the light. There's no truth in him. And now in rebellion towards God, towards God's plan, and against anything that is happening among mankind. And he is going to become the first world leader. The Cush was the father of Nimrod, the rebel, who grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. Now how is he gaining? It says he grew. The word actually in the Hebrew means began or came, grew into the state. He wasn't this way, but he is progressing forward. He has a goal. He has an attitude. He is a rebel against God. And that means nothing except here he is. Here's this guy that's against God's plan. But as time ticks away, he began to take effect. And he began to accomplish this first by being a warrior. The government was established. We see Moses or Noah having been told by God to establish governments. That God is now to judge man. God is in a position where he is using that position, the position of leadership, the position of government, to hold everybody under his thumb to dominate the world. And here we go. He became a mighty warrior. That means he began to conquer. He began to conquer people, not rule people, not be the good shepherd. He began to dominate. Became the mighty warrior on the earth. Now we are in the third generation. Remember, Ham, Cush, Nimrod, there's a fourth generation coming. That's chapter 8. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, mighty hunter into his own hands to dominate people before the Lord. Before the Lord, again, you need to decide what this means. And again, there's no way, as far as I can tell, of knowing precisely what is meant by the Lord. Before the Lord can mean, and all this happened by the grace of God. God was with the man, and Nimrod went before the Lord and dominated people as the rebel. Okay? But that it could mean that. You do have the indication that the world, back to Genesis 6, the world was full of sin, and the world became corrupt before the Lord is watching the world corrupt his eyes before him. So it could be a negative context, especially since we've already seen that. For before the Lord can mean in precedence or ahead of the Lord. Watch. God had established government. He'd established the idea that men are to fill the earth, to scatter, which he's going to do because they won't scatter. He's going to scatter. Nimrod, the rebel, was a mighty hunter and conquered, dominated the people instead of governing them before or ahead of the Lord's plan. In other words, what we probably have here, especially when you tie together the idea of a mighty hunter, mighty is used three times right here in the NIV. Mighty is means, the, again, it's the Hebrew word gabor, which means advance, mighty, the... He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, meaning he... that put his plans ahead of God's plans. which you can read very clearly in chapter 11. We are going to do this in our own way. So probably, however you do this, Nimrod, a mighty hunter, ahead of the Lord's plans, doing it his own way. The first sinners of he is a king, and he is developing a kingdom, and the first, he grew to be a mighty hunter, he grew to be a mighty warrior, he is dominating, and now he's in that position, he now begins to build his kingdom, building some of the great cities. Babel, or Babylon, means the gate of God. He's building a city, and it's called the gate of God, meaning this is going to be the headquarters of some kind of worship. Now, legend picks up Nimrod. We won't have time to go into this. We used to spend a lot more time talking about this. But Nimrod, as legend goes, and it referred to other places in the Old Testament, he's going to have a son named Tammuz, as legends go. And you can read about Tammuz in Ezekiel. God is in Ezekiel are still chewing the Israelite people out in 580 BC because they are worshiping who is a descendant of Nimrod who married a woman named Semiramis. Now, at this point, there's nothing about Semiramis in Scripture, so I'm not going to spend very much time on it. But Semiramis, and as history goes, and you can see that this is a great study if we would pursue this. Semiramis was, as legend go, as the stories go, was a beautiful woman who was very dominant, and she was worshipped. She accepted human sacrifices in Babel, in the gate of God. And they're building these huge structures with altars on them. And both Nimrod and Semiramis end up being worshipped, even after they died. They are the forerunners of the husband-wife-goddess team, God and God, that are going to take out the Old Testament until they go to Babylonian captivity. They show up as Asheroth, the woman Asheroth, or Asherah, and the male god Baal. Always associated with the pole and the Baal stone. That is a continuation of this worship of these two people that began in Babel and as was handed down. Every culture has it. Every culture, just like the flood stories in every culture, there's some form of this in every culture, and it's infected every form of religion. The worship of the male deity and the female deity, the idea there, Nimrod was killed and Tammuz took his place. And it becomes, hang on, we can't go very far with this without becoming offensive. It becomes the mother god and the son god. And the mother and son are worshipped as being God, as being deity. You see it all the way through Israel. You can see it going into the Greek culture. You can see it in the Roman worship. It's all the way through. And eventually Christianity is going to catch up with the Greek and Roman culture that originated out of Babylon and this time period. All just keeps flowing wherever the cultures go. They conquer culture and it just switches over. It's like a demonic spirit. It's like a religion in itself. And when Christianity catches up to Rome, they adopt the same practice, and we'll go no further with that. It is an interesting thing, the two gods being worshipped, the mother and the son god. Anyway, that's enough of that, but you can see that in history coming through that. Tammuz is still worshipped in Israel as the son, and they mourn for him because Tammuz was killed one day by a wild boar. And 3 days later, he was resurrected, which led to the spring and fertility. And that is why Ezekiel is really railing on the people, because they're worshiping Tammuz. And you can see that in the book of Ezekiel. But nonetheless, the centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Kelna in Shinar. And then he moved on into Assyria. And he is in a place of world domination. This is not going to work out. This is not God's plan. I want you to notice right here that by the time we get to that fourth generation, this plan is stopped. During what? I'm going to show you when it is. Watch carefully. Go to chapter 10, verse 21. Just jumping ahead here. The sons also born to Shem, whose older brother was Japheth. Shem was the ancestor of the sons of Eber. Watch. I want you to notice these names right here. Shem first. That's the same generation as Ham. Arphaxhead. That's the same generation then as Canaan. Arphaxhead is going to have a son named Shelah, which is the same, in verse 24, the same generation as Nimrod. And Shelah's going to have a son named Eber, which is the fourth generation. And something's going to snap in that fourth generation, potentially. I think so. Because Eber is going to have two sons. One of them, in verse 25, he was born in the fourth generation, and his name is Peleg, P-E-L-E-G. And Eber names his son Peleg. Of course, I know Peleg's the fifth generation, but it's during that fourth generation, during Eber's generation, that something happens, and he names his son Peleg, and you can see, well, read right there, verse 25. One was named Peleg because in his time, the earth was divided. That means in the generation following Nimrod, during his son's generation, or that fourth generation, God divided the earth. God said something, it's like, hey, the earth is really not very interesting. I'm going to divide it. Or it could have been a response of judgment, especially when you tie it together with chapter 11, where God divides the earth with languages. Now, this is not a point of doctrine. This is not a point of doctrine. Clearly, in chapter 11, God confuses the languages, and that causes the people to separate. That says that very clearly. This verse, which is said here and also in 1 Chronicles, this verse right here, the word Peleg, comes from the word division, which is a word that means canals or channels. It is a word that means divisions of channels with water in them. The word Peleg means divisions of channels with water in them. And so what takes place here apparently has nothing to do with language. It could be a reference to chapter 11. That's simple. It could be. This verse, the earth was divided in Peleg's day. Either way, it's still the fourth generation, the generation after Nimrod, God divided the earth. That's chapter 11. But here when it says in Peleg's day, the earth was divided, when his name means the water channels, we could be talking about the continental plates breaking apart or something taking place and being moved. Of course, now you're into geology, you got all kinds of science you got to back that up with, and what's taking place. But it's mentioned several times there. Either way, in that fourth generation, God intervenes because of Nimrod's actions. What is interesting about Nimrod, my friends, is this right here. He is from the line of Ham. He establishes Babylon. He establishes Assyria. He establishes a one-world government in rebellion towards God. He is a king. I'm going to give you now, please. I'm going to give you eight correlations between this Nimrod and who he is a foreshadowing of. This Nimrod, of course, there's one main character in the Bible that Nimrod is a foretaste of. That God says, no, not yet, and intervene with the Tower of Babel, possibly the continental plates, if you want to push that. But he comes down to that fourth generation and says, it's not going to happen this time. And he separates them and puts time off until he can have his plan work out in the earth. Now, Nimrod is a forerunner or a shadow of what Satan has been trying to do since the beginning. And that is unite the world together against God. Satan is against God and he wants to establish his kingdom on the earth. You've got to get out of your mind that evil and sin are synonyms. Sin is wickedness, wickedness against God. It's a wickedness against what's moral, of what's right. It's unrighteousness. Evil describes things that oftentimes are not considered sinful. Evil is rebellion towards God. Evil is godlessness. Evil sometimes can be the right things just without God. Evil is education without God. Evil is any kind of a system, if it be government, if it be an organization, without God. Evil is Nimrod who wants the world his way without God. It doesn't say they were sinful. I'm sure they were. But the idea here is they do not want God. Satan's goal is to be God. He wants to be God. Whatever God is, Satan wants to be. If Jesus Christ is going to rule and reign the planet, what does Satan want to do? Rule and reign the planet. If God wants people to live together, Satan wants people to live together. He wants harmony. Now listen to me. Satan is trying to duplicate God's plan. Satan is trying to prove that he is God. Satan thinks he's God. Satan's plan is not, stay with me, Satan's plan is not to destroy people. Satan's plan is not just to kill everybody. Satan's plan, he wants to be God. And so he's going to do everything he can to create a world without God, with him in that place of God. Nimrod is his man. He's getting it to take place. Now watch this. What is one of, this is speculation, this is what I think. Like you care. What is Satan's biggest frustration as he works man into his system? It is man's sin nature. Because man, without Jesus Christ, self-destructs. Without Jesus Christ, man is going to collapse. Satan cannot get this plan to work because he gets it so far. We're going to talk about the tribulation just briefly here in a moment. But the tribulation, it begins the same way. World peace, a world leader, everybody happy and living together. But by 3.5 years into that place, mankind cannot function successfully for any length of time without Jesus Christ. And Satan's plan will always be thwarted by, guess what? Man's sin nature. Man will always destroy anything Satan does. The only way man is going to make it is with Jesus Christ. These are some similar things. I want to read 3 verses, please. Go to Daniel first, Daniel chapter 11. And there is another man coming, like a Nimrod, and this time God is going to step back, and it's going to be time. He's going to allow the new Nimrod to accomplish his purpose. He's going to put him right back in Babylon. He's going to let him go right back and say, Satan, go for it. Take it. We're ready. Everything in the kingdom of God is ready for you to try to make this thing work. And Nimrod, I didn't used to believe this. I didn't used to think this. I would read, and again, I would read when it talks about Babylon being rebuilt. Remember in Revelation it talks Babylon the Great? I would figuratize that. I'd spiritualize that. Babylon would refer to one of the great world centers, maybe New York or maybe Rome or something. But the longer we look at this, and again, this is just my own ideas, the longer we look at this, I'm now teaching, at least potentially, that the Antichrist kingdom or his city Babylon is, guess what? The Bible, when it says Babylon, it means Babylon. I couldn't teach that 20 years ago, 10 years ago. It was, Babylon's a dust bowl. There's nothing there. It's like, that doesn't even make any sense. But so was Israel 100 years ago. And Israel's now back on the map, and I believe Babylon's going to be back on the map. And I believe, here we go, last week we saw in chapter 38 and 39 the invasion of Japheth and the elimination of Japheth from history. Okay, Japheth is done. Now, of course, there's still descendants of Japheth around. You know, the Western societies are still there. But they are now neutralized. They're done. What's left now after the invasion of Gog in chapter 38 and 39, what's left is Shem and Ham. And at this point, things go back to Ham. Now it's Ham's turn. And Ham is going to rise up another man. Now some people say the Antichrist has got to be Jewish. Okay? Could be. Some people say the Antichrist has to come from the Europe. From Japheth. Could be. But as we look at this, he could be coming right out of Ham. Or he could be coming right out of this area here. And here are some things that you can see the correlation. These are the correlations I'm going to show you. These things. Nimrod was a rebel. The Antichrist is going to be the lawless one or the rebel. They are both going to head up a confederacy or a kingdom against God. They are going to have their own will. Nimrod went before the Lord. The Antichrist is going to promote his own will before the Lord. He was called, Nimrod is called Mighty Hunter, Mighty Warrior. The Antichrist is going to have all power and all signs. I'm going to read these verses to you. He was a hunter of men, or hunter, a warrior. Same thing, the Antichrist is going to be big. His God, he's going to worship a God of fortress. His God is going to be war. He's going to dominate by power. They're both going to be kings. They're both going to be in Babel or Babylon. And they're going to make himself a name, and or exalt himself above God. Here we go. I got three sets of verses I'm going to read to you as we wrap this up. This is now the end of Ham. We saw the end of Japheth last week, or their rebellion against God. This is now Ham's rebellion against God. Always coming against, Japheth comes against Israel. Now Ham is going to come against Israel. Chapter 11 of Daniel, verse 36. The king, the Antichrist, will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. Describing the Antichrist. Same attitude as Nimrod, the rebel. Chapter 11, verse 36, we're still in that verse. He will be successful until the time of wrath. Nimrod was successful until the time came. For what he has been determined must take place. For what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers, or for the one desired by women. The god of his fathers probably refers to any kind of the gods, you know, whatever god they had worshipped. The one desired by women would probably be a reference to the Messiah, the seed of the woman. Nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. And that is what Nimrod ends up doing, as he becomes a god figure. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortress, a god unknown to his fathers. He will honor the gold with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortress with the help of a foreign god, and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. So here it says a foreign god. Paul is going to definitely say Satan. He's going to have the backing of Satan's power to pull these things off. He'll make them rulers over many people, and will distribute the land at a price. So he's conquering and uniting by force, by power. We could read on more about the events of the Antichrist there. Go to 2 Thessalonians. Let's go to the New Testament, please. 2 Thessalonians. 2 Thessalonians chapter 4. Just like Japheth, when Gog brings down his coalition against Israel, God intervenes and overthrows Japheth. Now when the Antichrist is in the middle of his kingdom, in the middle of his reign, Jesus Christ himself is going to overthrow him. Paul addresses this in chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians. I'll just begin chapter 2, verse 1. Concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, he is coming back, and are being gathered to him. We're going to go to him somewhere. At the second coming, Jesus is going to come to the earth. At this right here, we're going to be gathered to him. We'll not become easily unsettled by some prophecy, report, or letter supposed to have come from us. So the Thessalonians have got some false information, some pseudo letters been floating around, saying that the day of the Lord has already come. The day of the Lord is that day of judgment. Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs. Interesting word right there. The falling away. The rebel. Rebellion comes. And the man of lawlessness is revealed. Meaning he's going to be around. He's going to be trying to get on the scene, but he's not going to take place until he's revealed. The man doomed to destruction. What will he be like? Verse 4. He will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God. A mighty hunter before the Lord. A mighty hunter ahead of God's plan. If you interpret that, you could say God's grace that allowed him to be a mighty hunter. But clearly here is not saying that. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. I was with you to tell you things. know what's holding him back. It may be revealed at the proper time. Still controlling history. Free will happening, but God is controlling it, holding it back. You can decide to do whatever you want to do. You just won't be allowed to do it. You have free will, but you just can't act on it. This man's got free will. Satan wants to rule the planet now. That's his will. But God's just saying, you can have your will, but it ain't going to happen. Now it will. Verse 7. For the secret power of lawlessness, I want you to hear that word. Secret is the word mysterion. The mystery power of lawlessness. This is not just written today. This was written almost 2,000 years ago. That mystery is already. It's been working since the beginning. The mystery of lawlessness, the mystery of rebellion, evil, is already at work. But the one who now holds it back will continue to do so till he is taken out of the way. Now, who's holding it back? And we've discussed this before. I believe that's the church. Church age is over, boom. It could be an angel, it could be the Spirit of God. This is where they get the teaching that you can't be saved in the tribulation because the Spirit's taken out of the way, which isn't true because this thousand people are saved. I believe it's the Spirit in the church. Nonetheless, whatever it is, when he is taken out of the way, then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy by the splendor of his coming. The coming of the lawless one, or this new Nimrod, will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of miracles, signs, and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing. They perish because they refuse to love the truth and be saved. For this reason, God sends a powerful, and this is a scary thought, a powerful delusion coming so that they will believe a lie. God is going to send a delusion that will be so or a powerful delusion that is so powerful and is so that you understand what I just said? I can give you apologetics on why there's logic. We can give you apologetics on archaeological proof on why we know the Bible's true. We got apologetics. There's different forms of apologetics, if it be physical evidence, if it be logic. But when this powerful delusion comes on the earth, potentially, I understand it this way, it's so powerful that there's no apologetics. It's not like, oh my gosh, you either believe or you don't believe. And if you haven't believed the truth, if you haven't embraced the truth when we were in the church age, or if you haven't embraced the truth when apologetics and the Spirit of God was working, if you don't have faith and confidence, when you see this powerful delusion, it's going to be like, I can't. I'm not going to be able to come to church that day if the church is still there. I'm not going to be able to come to church that day and explain it to you. It's going to be like, oh my gosh, there's no explanation. It's so powerful. And those who don't have the truth, who have rejected the truth, are going to go hook, line, and sinker so that they will believe a lie and so that all will be condemned who have not believed the truth but have delighted in wickedness. This is a day that is coming.